Former Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson joins the show. And Eddie, I want to ask you, did you get everything shoveled out there? I heard you did some digging over the weekend. You were pretty busy. How are you?
I'm good, Eddie. Thanks for asking. You know, to be quite honest, I got one more little piece of parking space to complete, then I'll be done all the way.
That's good to hear. You know, we've had a lot of ground to cover, a lot of things to talk about. I just want to thank you for coming on, first of all. It's not easy to talk about a lot of this stuff. And I want to get your perspective on crime. I also want to talk about the circumstances surrounding your departure from the police department. And you're cool with all that, right? You told me that.
Yeah. You know, I will tell you this right off the bat. You know, I took a lot of time. You know, this is the most significant amount of time I've been not working in 31 years, you know, so I had to take time, especially after everything happened. It was just important for me to take time to reflect on things, you know, and both professionally and personally. And, you know, I was asked a question before, why am I speaking out now? And to be quite honest, you know, I had to take that time to reflect on things and take care of the people that were closest to me, you know, and really kind of look at my own mental and emotional health. You know, and those are things that you know, you just can't say you're going to be a better person or come out of something a better person. You actually have to take the time and put the effort in to try to learn some things you've done in the past. And to be honest, that, you know, that's a job that's never done, but you still have to take the time to do it.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, and I've made the point, I've spoken out when this whole thing first unfolded with the situation of you being found in your car slumped over and those rank and file officers knocked on your window. And that was sort of the beginning of all these other events that occurred. And I want to ask you about that. But I made the point of sticking up for you that time because I felt like 31-year career does not get erased and all the good you did by that one incident. We've learned more about it, though. And I just want to ask you now, you know, as you look at what happened that day, obviously, you'd want to do things differently. None of us is perfect. How do you reflect on that moment, what those choices you made that led up to that?
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right. And I appreciate you, you know, giving me the benefit of doubt or just acknowledging, you know, that we're not perfect people, you know. And of course, if I had things to do differently, of course I would, you know. And I think that I, you know, as a superintendent, I think I did a pretty good job being the superintendent. But where I failed was just, or where I fell short was being a person, you know, and being a husband. And, you know, when I look back on that thing, that particular incident, you know, I should have protected all of us that were involved in that better, you know. And, you know, I was never interviewed, of course, you know, before everything happened. So, you know, as I said, I had been drinking that night. But the other part of that also was that the medication that, you know, I had the kidney transplant and my doctors had taken me off of certain medications and I was supposed to replace them with some new ones. And I didn't, you know, and that's my fault, you know. But mm-hmm. that particular night,
I had been drinking involved that night, right? I mean, we know the story now that there was a lot of drinking. You shouldn't have gotten behind the wheel. You know that. And then that's how you got to that point, right, where those officers were knocking on your window trying to find out what was going on with their boss.
Right. Yeah. I shouldn't have been drinking like that night. But at the same time, the reason I pulled over was what I said it was. You know, I kind of felt the same sensation I felt before I had passed out once before. Now, don't get me wrong. I had been drinking and I wasn't planning on falling asleep. But that's what happened, you know, and I'm not perfect. I'm not. Mm-hmm. But would I do things differently? Of course I would.
Yeah, I guess the mayor's decided. You were weeks away from retirement. The mayor decided to fire you because of you lied to her, is what she said. She said very publicly, you lied to me about it, and I had no other choice than to do that. Do you understand her perspective there? How do you feel about that?
Well, I can, believe me, Anna, at the time, if you think back to it, that's when the teachers were going on strike. And I can understand her anger with it and frustration. You know, I did try to give her an overview of what happened, but in all honesty, I knew there was going to be an investigation. So, you know, we know as police officers, when an investigation is launched, you're not supposed to really talk about it until the investigators talk to you. And it's not a defense, but it's just so that you don't appear to be trying to steer things one way or the other. So I understand her anger with it. But to just say I flat out lied, I would not agree with that characterization of it. But if that's the way she saw it, then that's her truth.
Yeah. I think one of the things I think that has always stood out about you, too, as being in the department and rising as you did first, it's your story. Any of us who've grown up in Chicago and see someone like you who's from the neighborhoods, you were in Cabrini-Green the first 10 years of your life, no stranger to seeing crime in your neighborhood and the impact it had on you and how that shaped your views. And then you rose to be at the top of that department. And it is an incredible success story. And I just, I feel for you in many ways. I don't, obviously no one can support those choices. And I know you've had time to think about it since at the end of your career, that those kinds of things happen. One of the things that does come out all the time, too, is you had the respect of the rank and file. They really liked you and respect you, and that is not an easy thing to get. However, at the end, when those officers, those guys are still going to face penalties, the ones who let you go. And I feel for them, and I wonder how you feel about the circumstances for them, those rank and file members who kind of said, hey, that's the boss. I don't want, I got to get away from here. I'm not going to do nothing.
You know what? Listen, I feel horrible for those guys that they had to face any disciplinary anything because of something that I did. Now, I will say this. If you looked at the video, you saw after they woke me up, they kind of startled me. And after a few seconds, I was talking to them like I'm talking to you right now. You know, so I feel horrible for them because they shouldn't have gotten caught up in something like that. And I put them in that situation, and all I can do is apologize to them for it. You know, I'm not exactly sure what penalties they received, but hopefully they weren't too bad. And again, I feel terrible for putting them in that position.
Yeah, I think that was the part that I just heard from other officers, that they've always respected you. You know, I mean, you were picked as a superintendent, we want to remind people. You were appointed after the three Correct. Candidates they were looking at were not what they wanted to see. And they said, well, whatever, you can come up with any. You were picked by Rahm Emanuel, handpicked at a time when the city was still reeling from the Laquan McDonald video being released, a time when we needed to heal. And he thought you would be a good person for that job. And some of those passionate speeches you gave, I think, really connected a lot of people to your message. Talk about that.
Well, you know what? I've always tried to do the right thing. You know, I'm not a perfect person. I don't know anybody out there that is. But I do think that I connected with the rank and file, you know, because I started as a PPO and rose up through the ranks. You know, I've always tried to be honest, always tried to be transparent, and I always tried to look out for the rank and file as well as the citizens. So I spent a lot of time. People don't know this, but I would work routinely 12, 14-hour days, 6 or 7 days a week, and I would either be in the community talking to people, both good and bad, or I'd be out in the communities, you know, talking to the rank and file, you know, because both sides need to know that you have empathy for them and that you see it their way. Now, it's hard to put those things together, don't get me wrong, but I think me and my staff, we did a good job in bringing the community back to CPD. And those rank and file officers, you know, that almost 4 years I was there, they did an incredible job. And I'm really sorry that I wasn't there like last year to help them through that, because it is difficult to get the respect of the community and the rank and file at the same time. But I think that we did a good job in doing that.
I would say so. I would say you really did. And that is not an easy thing to do. And that was a time when we needed someone exactly like you to help us through that time. I want to ask you about crime fighting strategies and some other things in the situation with crime. I know you follow it very closely, Eddie. Can you respond, though, quickly before we pause here for a minute? I'm going to have to take a break and then we'll pick it up on the other side. But respond to the sexual abuse accusation. I know you cannot talk specifically because there's litigation. Is there anything you want us to know? You have a subordinate who's accusing you of this abuse kind of thing. Anything you want people to know about that?
Yeah, you know, listen, I've been on this planet 60 years now, and 31 years as a cop. I've never, ever been accused of anything remotely like that. You know, I pray for her and her family, because I'm sure this isn't easy for them, but I do want people to know I'm not that guy. You know, I've never abused anyone. Never forced myself on anyone. You know, it was a consensual relationship. It was a mistake on both of our parts, you know, and that's where, you know, when I was talking about, I fell short. I fell short as a man and as a husband, you know, that's where I fell short. So I just want people to know, at the end of this, the truth will come out. You know, I have God and the truth on my side. So I'm fairly confident of that. The challenge is getting to the end, because there's just a lot of bumps that's going to be in front of me along the way. In the end, the truth will come out. But I just want people to really know, you know, I've always tried to be honest, transparent, and I've never had a reason to do things like that. So I just want them to know that I'm not that person. I'm that person that you all would see out on the street, in the community, on TV. That's the person that I am.
Yeah. When you say bumps in the road, are you saying more stories will come up because it's in litigation? Is that what you mean?
No. I'm not saying more stories will come up. It's just, you know, you have to go through it. That's what I mean
by that.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you just have to go through it. And you know, I have to, again, you know, I had to really look down deep because I had to make sure, you know, my family and the people closest to me was okay, you know. And you know, it's one thing for my wife. I can't imagine what this is for her, because it's one thing when you make a mistake like that and step outside of your marriage. It's one thing for you and your family to know about it. It's another thing for the whole city and country to know about it, you know. So
sure.
I have to be really mindful of that, and that's what I mean by bumps in the road.
Yeah, I that's a very important point. It is really about your family, too. That's the healing that needs to be done first and foremost. Hey, Superintendent Johnson, can we pause for just a minute? We can pick up on the other side. I want to ask you some other things, in particular about the situation with crime in the city. I know you have thoughts about that. And
sure.
Just kind of get your perspective a little bit. Thank you. All right, our guest here is former superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, Eddie Johnson. And, hey, Eddie, we covered a lot of ground here, and thank you for doing that. Thanks for answering those questions. It's not easy to talk about, and I think just people in general do, you know, they wonder. They wonder about exactly what has happened there. And generally, you're saying that you've had time to think about it now, and looking back, obviously you wouldn't do things the same way, but you're looking at life a little differently now.
Of course, you know, and I tell you, Anna, you know, it's the support that I get when I go out of the house from the citizens of this city and the rank and file, it's incredible. And I want to thank them for that, you know, so, and that lets me know that I must have done something right, you know, but at the same time, you still have to acknowledge your faults, you know. So, no, this isn't easy to talk about, you know, and I know that people are curious about things. So to the extent that I can, you know, I don't mind talking about certain things.
Well, thank you for doing that. Well, I want to ask you to talk about crime in the city. As you know, you care about these things. I know you do, Eddie. And to tell me what's your read as we see the numbers are just not good from shootings,
you know,
and homicides, carjacking. Oh, my gosh. What do you think?
It's Jesus Christ. It's very concerning. You know, when I left, we had finally gotten the homicides down under 500, you know. So those numbers speak for themselves. But I think that now, and I'm sure the superintendent and the department is doing the best that they can, but clearly we have to do some other things, you know, to get this back under control, because it's very alarming. You know, I look at the carjacking situation, and we had a spike, if you remember. We had a spike, and I believe it was 2017, and we put our heads together and came up with a plan, and we knocked it down in about 4 or 5 months. You know, we had really gotten that back under control. So I think what was happening is that, first of all, you know, when people commit crimes like this, it's not so much the penalties that you place on them, but there has to be a certainty of a consequence, you know. And I'm not saying, like these juvenile offenders, you don't lock them up and throw them away forever, but there has to be a certainty of a consequence. And if there's not, then you're saying, well, okay, let's wait until they age out. We don't have that luxury, you know. So I think right now, And I think that they're doing this to a certain extent. It's a good idea for CPD, the surrounding suburbs, you know, our federal partners. Everybody come to the table and put a plan together. I know they have a task force going. And then you also have to bring in the state's attorney, because all that is fine and well, but if you don't have a certainty for the consequence, then you're still going to be spinning your wheels. So all those partners have to sit down together and figure out the best way to attack it. So, you know, I'm not there now, so I don't know exactly what they're doing. I heard that they stood up a task force, which is good, but then you have to put the resources in there. And then at the end of the day, if you get these offenders, if you place them in custody, they have to know there's going to be a consequence.
I hear you when you say that. And I hear that a lot from police officers who on the show and those I just talked to outside of it. What, how is this going? Why can't we seem to get this under control? And when you say that, it seems to tell me that you believe that once the juveniles or any of the folks get into the system, that they're not seeing that. And then the word gets out on the street that that's okay. Is that what you believe is happening?
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm hearing from people out on the street. And, you know, let's face it. It's no secret to any police officer that's worth their salt. It is no secret that the older offenders will use the juvenile offenders to commit these kinds of crimes, and that's why they do it. Because the system for juveniles is just not as stringent as it is for adults. Now, and again, Anna, I've never been a fan of mass incarceration or anything of that type. But however, if you commit a crime, you do have to know if you get caught, there's a consequence. And, you know, with these juveniles out here, 15, 14, 15, 16 years old, you know, you don't lock them up and throw away the key, but you do have to let them know there's a penalty to that action, because the word gets out there quickly that, hey, if you steal a car, you get caught, this is what's going to happen, and you're out the next day or even that same day. Believe me, the criminal element know the laws a lot better than we do most of the time, because they have to. Their job is to commit the crime and get away with it. Our job is for them to commit the crime and us catch them or prevent them from committing the crime in the first place.
Let me ask you a harder question. The other thing that people talk about is, why are they committing these crimes? What should be done to sort of, what are we not doing to help provide other outlets, other opportunities, other place, other choices for kids who are doing this to do something positive with their life?
Yeah, that's a huge part of it, too. You know, while I was there, I spent a lot of time in the community and with past offenders, juvenile offenders, and potential juvenile offenders. So you just have to create environments that gets their mindset away from doing these types of things, because that old saying, an idle mind is the devil's playground, is absolutely correct. You know, so we have to get into those disenfranchised communities and create mechanisms so that they'll have more time to do other things and therefore not commit these crimes. Now, I don't know how much they're doing now. I know what we were doing back then. You know, we had created these cafe events where we would send police officers out to talk to juvenile offenders and potential juvenile offenders, just to let them see the path that they were going down is the wrong path. But we also got there and partnered up with a lot of folks in the clergy and in the business communities to create jobs for these kids. You know, Arnie Duncan was a big part of that. Father Flager was a big part of that, just to name a few. I know there's some that I've forgotten now, mm-hmm. but those are the types of things you need to do. You need to create other avenues, because let me tell you this, Anna, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. You have some folks out there that's just going to commit crime. That's just what they do. But then you have a lot on the fringe that you can point in a different direction. They just have to have someone show them that direction to go to. You know, a lot of them, we take it for granted that people just know the right things to do in life and how to get along day to day. But that's not always true. You know, like you have kids in the inner city that have never been to the lakefront. That's ridiculous. You know, you live in a city like this, everybody should have those experiences at one point or another. So we just have to do a better job as a city, as a society, to be honest, of creating a different environment for these kids to thrive.
You talk about consequences there. We've talked about this on the show a lot. I wonder what you think. In 2016, they changed the laws so that a carjacking charge no longer triggers an automatic transfer to adult court if you're under 18. You talk about how people know that on the street. They're aware of this. And you said older offenders get the younger guys to do these sorts of crimes. One thing that maybe people don't know about you maybe is that you spent time in Springfield. You've been lobbying for criminal justice reform. You've been trying to find these solutions. And here we are today. Some folks believe that the criminal justice reform has tipped in the direction of the criminals over victims. I don't know how you feel about that or where we should be right now.
Yeah, because, you know, I would go to Springfield, and I tell you, and I would get so frustrated sometimes because, you know, look, we see what's going on out here. You know, we're not blind to it. So you have to create that environment that they know that there's going to be a consequence. Because, look, they know about automatic transfers. They know about the point system. And they will go right up to that tipping point with a particular kid so that he won't go into the, you know, the point system, so he won't go over. You know, so we have to recognize that. Our legislators have to recognize that. You know, like I said, you know, I'm a black man that grew up in Chicago. You know, I have friends that spent their whole lives in Cabrini-Green. So I know the mindset of folks that get into these types of things. And I can tell you, if we do a better job with our legislature and creating certain laws, it will deter certain people from committing these crimes. Now, I'm not saying it will everybody, and I'm not saying some people aren't victims of their environment, but most of these guys know right from wrong. They do. They just know that if they mm-hmm. commit these particular crimes, not much is going to happen. So why should they quit? We have to give them a reason to quit. And, you know, as citizens, we have to press our legislators to do that, you know, because once they know there's a certainty, and that's the key to it, a certainty, once mm-hmm. they know that, then they will slow down on these what they're doing. And these carjackings, let's face it, the technology for vehicles is a lot more sophisticated now.
Sure.
So in order for, yeah, so they don't hotwire cars like they used to back in the day. They have to get the key fobs from people. And when we see these things, you know, it's ridiculous to me. Like you said, the laws changed back in 2015 that don't create those automatic triggers. Where we see where that's gotten us. We see yeah. where it's gotten us. So we got to make it a little bit. Yeah.
I'm running out of time here, Eddie. Let me just ask you, the crime reform bill that's currently on the governor's desk, would you sign it as is? Does it need some work? Do you have a quick answer to that?
I think, you know, I haven't looked at the entire thing. It's a lot better than it was, and we do have to have reform, don't get me wrong, but I probably would not sign it at this point.
Hmm. Your health, finally, are you doing okay? I know you had the kidney transplant. Your son gave you one of his kidneys. Everything health-wise, how are you feeling?
Man, I feel great. My kidney numbers are outstanding right now.
Nice.
So I just have to keep working on that. I've actually trimmed down quite a bit, you know, so my doctors are really happy with that. So life is pretty good right now. So,
good.
You know, one day at a time.
Glad to hear it. And Eddie, thanks for spending time with us and answering the tough questions and providing your perspective, too. I really appreciate the time. I do.
No problem, Anna. Anytime. Just give me a ring.
Okay, you take care. It's almost 3 o'clock. That was former Superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, Eddie Johnson.